This episode is brought to you by C90 Ocean Minerals, the first step in regenerative agriculture. C90 offers a complete spectrum of organic minerals and trace elements that feed soil bacteria and fungi to regenerate your soil matrix and improve soil fertility. Soil with improved microbiology and mineral nutrition will grow protein-packed and nutrient-rich pastures that your animals will thrive on and yield more productive row crops and produce. Plus, their premium mineral salt offers 5 times the valuable minerals and trace elements versus leading competitors. Give them a call at 717-580-1458, and their experts will develop a custom program that fits your operation. Or visit their website to order smaller quantities, including for your garden. Learn more at c-90.com. That's sea-90.com. Or give them a call at 717-580-1458. From Acres USA, you're listening to Tractor Time, a conversational podcast where we'll explore sustainable farming, regenerative practices, and the latest innovations in eco-agriculture with some of your favorite farmers and ranchers. I'm your host, Sarah Wenzel Fisher, the Executive Director of the Kavira Coalition. Welcome to Tractor Time. Today we're talking with Harry Green. Harry is the Chief Research Officer at Propagate Ventures. He's an agroforestry agronomist focusing on finance and economics for useful trees on working farms, including orchards, windbreaks, silvopasture, and alley cropping. Why trees? Harry spent years trail running, swimming, and kayaking, which is where he made the connection between forests, clean air, and clean water. Why agroforestry? Harry believes that farms that grow our food can also support flourishing ecology and create just livelihoods. Harry and co-founders Jeremy Kaufman and Ethan Steinberg incorporated Propagate Group, a public benefit corporation, in 2017. Propagate makes it easy for land managers to integrate profitable tree crops into working farms by bridging the capital and operational gaps needed to plant and manage productive agroforestry systems. They believe better information begets great land management. Before an MBA, Harry spent 2 years as a resident modern pentathlete at the Colorado Springs Olympic Training Center. He competed on the World Cup circuit and in the 2015 World Championships in Berlin. Harry currently resides in Trumansburg, New York, farming chestnuts, black locusts, and other tree crops on 50 acres, in addition to his work with Propagate. Today we have joining us Harry Green. He is the Chief Research Officer at Propagate. Harry, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So Harry, just to get the ball rolling, I'd love to have you introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your role at Propagate and how did you get there?
How did we get here? Yeah. So my name's Harry. I live in Trumansburg, New York. It's about 15 minutes north of Ithaca. I have a farm there that's about two years old and grew up in Eastern Massachusetts, went through Vermont, lived in Colorado for a bit. Currently the co-founder and chief research officer at Propagate. Propagate, we started in 2016, incorporated in 2017 with the three of us. That's Ethan Steinberg, Jeremy Kaufman, and myself, three co-founders. We raised a Series A recently. Now we have a team of 20 or so people from, California through the Midwest, some folks in Massachusetts and Vermont, one team member in Europe. So the team's growing and the impact is as well. We started off with the thesis that the private sector could make agroforestry move quickly, and we've largely been correct there, having more capital flow towards trees for both ecological benefit and financial profit and rural livelihoods has generally been successful. We're a public benefit corporation, so we do have ecosystem services and rural livelihoods written into our charter. The goal of people, planet, profit all overlapped is generally our trajectory.
That's great. I remember meeting Ethan maybe the first year that you all had started, and it's exciting to me to see how the work you're doing has grown and really has taken off. And I think that it's also exciting to see policy begin to lean into helping to really increase adoption of agroforestry, as well as the private sector. Having the public sector present for that work also seems pretty cool. So you have an article in one of the most recent issues of Acres magazine, and that article opens up with a question: how can we fund regenerative agroforestry? And I'm curious if you can respond to that question here on the podcast a little bit, and just talk about generally what is the philosophy of how we fund regenerative agroforestry.
Absolutely. And there's a lot there. So please stop me and ask questions if we should dive more deeply into any of this. But what's curious about agroforestry, at least how we generally view it in the United States, and we'll say the global north, is that it provides so on-farm income and ecological and social benefit. And the latter we often fund with the public sector, and the former is often more private sector oriented. So the types of value that agroforestry creates are conducive to a very multi-stakeholder environment. And independent of, we'll say, who is funding agroforestry, it's really important to understand how much establishment is going to cost, how much maintenance is going to cost, and say harvest, et cetera. So your costs, your revenues, your yields, your labor assumptions, how many people hours per year, per season, a certain tree system is going to require is incredibly important to, you have to start there, no matter how you're funding it. And if you're looking at positive returns, say from a silvopastoral system or chestnut alley cropping, then you're really going to be queuing up those financial models for the private sector business case. And at the same time, that can be funded with subsidies, whether that's for water quality, flood mitigation, biodiversity, carbon. And if we're looking at things like riparian buffers, where it's the downstream water quality increase that really is that value add, we still want to know how much that's going to cost. So to fund any of this, it's really important to catalog the costs and the benefits over 30 plus years.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about how you do that. I know that Propagate has a pretty comprehensive planning process, maybe even a planning software that you all use. Do you want to dive a little bit deeper both into the like logistics of how that planning happens, but also what does that planning tell you about some of that cost benefit analysis?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we started off with agroforestry, finance and economics and design, say layouts where trees go, performing all of that with Google Earth and other GIS platforms and Excel spreadsheets. So that would take maybe 40 hours per farm after a few repetitions. And now the software that we currently have has a lot of that automated down to where we can plan out a farm in maybe 4 hours. And what that looks like is understanding the farm's holistic context. So the wills, desires, goals of the primary and secondary decision makers on the farm. So primary being anyone who has veto power, or is just a main decision maker. And then the secondary decision makers are the people who generally have influence on the system. So you're understanding the human context as much as the, say, biogeophysical climate. So climate of the mind and then climate of the weather patterns, et cetera. Soil types, we rely really on, I'm just diving into the physical design, and then I'll circle back to how we look at the economics of all of this. But we follow the Riegerian's platform, also a lot of overlap with the key line scale of permanence. So just ran through number one, climate. Number two is geography. And that's the landform, the subsoil type, but also say what what the social geography is, that there's a little bit of overlap with the access layer there, but say how much access to markets and labor you have. Number three, so water, precipitation, irrigation, ponds, dams. Number four is roads, and then number five is trees. So to get to agroforestry, you have to understand a whole lot about the farm before you start prescribing trees for this place or the other. And once you get to an assortment of tree species that works for the physical landscape, you have to understand from the start every single step you are going to take or might take in the management of that system. So at installation, how are you digging holes with a tree planter, with an auger, with a shovel? Are you mulching? Are you using tree tubes or deer fence? What kind of soil amendments do you need? Fertilizer, biologicals, weed mats, is that coconut coir? Where is your source of wood chips coming from? So you have that, you have your installation costs, you have management costs like pruning, mowing, cultivation, and then harvest. And your labor rate really ripples through all of that. So you really have to understand not just what you can hire tasks out for, but what your own opportunity cost of time is and how much you want to monetize your own labor. On top of all of those costs, you want to understand the yield curve. So when does the crop first start to yield, or with timber, when is that first harvest? And then how much value add, how much value can you add to those crops? And in the same vein, what are the different price points? So if you have minimum value add, you have probably a lower farm gate price, but then you don't have to do any marketing. And then you have to really understand what you want to do, how much you want to insource in terms of marketing, and how much value add you have to undergo to achieve a certain price. So your returns at the end of the day are contingent on the costs to make everything work, and then how engaged you want to be and how engaged you can be in adding and capturing margin, capturing value, and making it work for your context.
I'm wondering if you could dive into either a specific case or a hypothetical case to help us understand a little bit better about like what is the farmer's experience working with Propagate. So I think that, you know, what you're describing is really exciting. It's a lot of information. And how would a farmer, you know, what's the process of being like, hey, I'd like to work with you all, and then diving into all of these big questions?
Yeah, we'll pull up some case studies, or I'll just bring those up in a few minutes or a certain amount of time. So the best way to get in contact with us is just through our website. You'll probably talk to Mark first, and everyone goes through Overyield, the software, in that planning process, and folks can engage with us just as a user of the software. So if they want to do all the farm planning themselves with a bit of advisory from Ali on our team, and then they generally have a good grasp on how they want to manage a tree system, and the software is very intuitive, then they can just run with that. And that's a, say, once a month cost or an annual cost, or they can work with our full farm services team. So that'll start with CJ or Seth or myself or Renan, or we call these folks either project managers or solutions designers. That's effectively that designer and financial analyst that will run through the holistic context development and understand what someone who's working with us really wants to do on their farm and kind of which crops fit there. I'll give a few examples on, we'll say, where different crops fit different contexts, and then speak to how folks can work with us following all of that. So different tree species, I'd say similar to different species of livestock, are better and worse fits with different, I guess, human personalities and just goals and amounts of time and how someone wants to live their life. So I'd say 200 acres of timber might have the same number of management hours as 10 acres of berries or something like that. I forget the actual ratio varies with involvement, value add, et cetera. So we have to understand, say, how many people someone wants to work with. And if they want to run a cidery, then organic apples or just apples in general might be a good fit. Or a U-pick blueberry operation or something like that. But if someone is much more inclined to work by themselves or just with a smaller family or a larger family, but not with too much outside labor, then something like timber silvopasture might make more sense. So it's the crop has to fit the person.
Sure. What's the crop at your farm?
Yeah. So I have, my farm is 50 acres in total. 15 of that is wooded. So 35 open. And of that 35, there are 15 acres of chestnuts and a good amount of black locust. And let's see, bitternut hickory. So those are the crops outside the deer fence. And I have a few acres left over, which are TBD, because every year I find new crops that I want to plant. So I probably have 3 acres open that I'll do something with maybe next year or the year after. And then inside my 3 acres of deer fence, half of that is nursery stock for propagate. And I have a friend who's leasing a half acre there. And then the other half inside the deer fence is it's a orchard with too many species of fruit in it. I think there are 15 types of fruit in rows. And that's not something I'd recommend for everyone. That's more something that is either a very large home orchard or a very small semi-commercial U-pick that I am putting some time into, but nothing too excessive.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that. I on the list of sort of like deeper dive topics that I've got for us is to talk about chestnut hay alley cropping systems or black locust. And so it sounds like you're working with both of those a little bit, which is pretty interesting that you're hands-on doing it yourself as well as helping others do it. I think there's a lot of value when folks are both in that technical service provision role as well as doing the work themselves. So kudos on
Thank
that. Do you want to pick one of those and we can sort of dive in a little bit deeper with a more specific example? And this may be a space also where you could share a little bit about a case study of some kind.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can speak to chestnuts on a smaller scale, and then maybe I'll start with what we're doing in Kentucky. So we have about 300 acres planted in Maysville, Kentucky, of Chinese chestnuts and with hay in the alleys. So we met a farmer named Kevin who had a chunk of owned and leased ground in Kentucky. He also has ground in Ohio, kind of wants to transition the ground, and he wanted to transition the ground in Kentucky to something else. So we walked him through everything chestnuts, and he was super interested. He's also an equipment dealer. So this is he was a great find, and a lot of his land and some of his neighbor's land is now planted to chestnuts. So chestnuts are great at this point in time, in that the, not just the domestic supply, but the global supply is lower than the demand. So they have generally good financial prospects for the next, say, 30 years plus. And yeah, so chestnuts, if you haven't had them, they're, we'll say a high quality carbohydrate. They're more calorically dense than potatoes. I think they're maybe, we can Google this, but it's like 540 calories per pound, and potatoes are like 300 to 340. But they don't make you feel heavy when you eat them, as you would if you ate like a kilo of pasta or something like that. So chestnuts are great. The hay in between the trees, they're all at 20 by 20 foot spacing. So you need smaller haying equipment to harvest the hay, but it's very, very doable. That over time will transition into likely a silvopastoral system. So stop haying it, introduce livestock.
This may be a tangential question, I'm not sure, but chestnut feels like a pretty specialty type of food. How involved is value add there? And it's interesting to learn that the demand is higher than production, but who buys chestnuts?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So at this point in time, it doesn't make financial sense for most scales of chestnut production, most sizes of chestnut production, to make chestnut flour or add value in that regard into a non-perishable shelf-stable product. People do that, usually with the B grades, and chestnut flour is amazing. I make pancakes and crepes and like chestnut flour apple bread with it. It's very good. Usually people just sell them as fresh nuts. And the buyers are usually people that don't speak English as a first language. So from China, Korea, Japan, Bosnia, Italy, France, those places that have intact chestnut cultures. You'll go to Spain at Christmas time and have people roasting chestnuts on the street, as we used to do in the US. But the markets right now, a lot of the time, come from recent immigrants to the US. I think for non-recent immigrants to the US, value add is going to be more important. So chestnut pancake mix, chestnut cookies, think like a Clif Bar having chestnuts in it, or your Starbucks croissant having some chestnuts in addition to chocolate.
This December, why not join the Acres USA community in Covington, Kentucky for our 48th annual EcoAg Conference and Trade Show. This exciting event brings together the leading voices in regenerative agriculture to offer practical advice based on personal experience and well-developed expertise. Each moment of programming is thoughtfully curated to provide practical, useful, and measurable information that you can apply to your operation. Our workshops and plenary sessions are led by experienced producers like John Kempf, Will Harris, Gary Zimmer, Mark Shepard, Reginaldo Haslett-Marroquin, Laura Kavanaugh, and many other innovative leaders working in the field. The week kicks off on Monday morning, December 4th, with three different incredible full-day EcoAg University intensive workshops to choose from. And our conference and trade show opens with a reception on the evening of Tuesday, December 5th, followed on Wednesday and Thursday by the conference program of 1 to 2 hour sessions and amazing keynotes. Dig into subjects like soil health, farm management, livestock integration, and more, or hop between them all as you spend time absorbing new information, making new connections and discoveries every day. Join us for the main conference and trade show, or decide to come early for the intensive EcoAg University. Either way, you can expect a fulfilling experience that will include exceptional learning from experienced growers and agronomists who have learned valuable lessons and are ready to share. For more information and to register, please go to our website, www.acresusa.com. See you in Covington.
Are you looking for the next bestseller for your favorite farmer or gardener? Visit the Acres USA bookstore to find the perfect gift for any loved one who likes getting their hands dirty. Find titles from great authors and farmers like Elliot Coleman, Mark Shepard, Andre Liu, and others. Get 20% off any Acres bookstore purchase with the discount code TT20. Can you talk a little bit about like time frame in this particular system? So when the producer that you were sharing about was like, yeah, that sounds like a chestnut, sounds like a tree crop for me. What was he looking at in terms of, you know, from making the decision to do that to point of harvest, or first harvest, and then, you know, yeah, just sort of talk about that time frame in a little more detail. Yeah. I'd love to hear, you know, how many years does it take to get a harvest? And then how many years does it take to get a substantive harvest? And I think maybe the third piece, not to throw too many questions at you, but how does a farmer think about making that make financial sense with the time frame? Because I'm imagining that's a relatively long time frame.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'll speak to Keevan's context first. He was and is a very successful grain farmer. Corn, soy has been using biologicals for 20 plus years. And he was ready for, I think, a new adventure. Chestnuts start to yield. If the soil is perfect and you mulch them a lot and you have good precipitation and you're in, say, southern Pennsylvania or something like that, you're going to get yields after 3 years. It won't be a heavy yield, but you will get yields. To underpromise, overdeliver, folks should expect yields after 6 or 7 years. And then depending on your climate and your management, you're going to look at break even at year 9 to 11 or so. If you're farther north and say it's drier or you have less management accrued, then break even is going to be later. So the trees differentiated from annual crops, there are a few ways to look at this. Over the long term, permanent crops, so perennials, generally have a higher return, a higher internal rate of return than annuals. You do have that time lag to yield, so you're not going to get income in the first year, in the first few years. And there is a significant cost to bring any sort of orchard to break even. And I guess just as an example, organic apples, say dwarf apples, you're looking at say $25,000 to $35,000 per acre to bring the system to break even. And not just to revenue, but to the point where your revenues eclipse all of the costs you've accrued over the past 5 plus years. And that's not to dissuade people from growing trees. I think we have to look at this in terms of not trees and understory crops or livestock being substitutes, but to what extent are they complements? So if you have wide spacing between trees, can you still grow crops in between those trees? And you can accomplish, we'll say, sustained income that way, or you can look at your tree system as, and you can look at your tree system as an asset that you have to, so you're looking at the long-term value, and you can overcome that time lag to yield with different sorts of financing. So people are generally familiar with debt financing, a mortgage, also looking at equity financing, where you can, if someone wants, so the way we work with, say, Keevan, for instance, is that we pay him a long-term lease to lease his land. And that's it's a market rate lease. But then we have either a revenue share where that landowner gets a cut of the revenue when it starts to yield, or they just get that lease payment there. So if you equity finance tree crops, if you have someone, you basically have a land partner come in, that's the way to have trees planted on your land. If you want to have another person or entity that you're working with to overcome that time lag to yield.
Can you talk about the duration of the leases that you have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 30 or 33 years with 3 extensions possible.
That's great. So like a 99-year lease essentially is what you're exactly looking at.
And just for clarity, I know I am a co-founder and part owner of Propagate, but Propagate is leasing the farm that I own So Propagate owns the trees and I own the land. So that's how I made that work. I could have just funded the whole thing myself, but in terms of cash flow, it made more sense to bring in that equity partner there. So I am also a case study in equity financing tree crops on both sides of the equation.
That's great. Are there any other models that you want to point to in terms of how patient capital shows up and works in these systems?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing we should note, and then I'll move on to things that are not purely Propagate related. We're in the next 3 years, we're looking at a debt vehicle for trees. So if someone just wants to take out a loan to plant trees, then they should definitely reach out to us either sooner or later. On the public sector side, the USDA just shot a money cannon at agroforestry to the tune of about $60 million, and $30 million of that is going directly to tree crops. Everything has to be designed first before they fund it, of course. So you'll have to apply through that. We are waiting for more detail on how to jump into the fold there. But there are cost shares available. One thing to note there is, I was thinking about this beforehand, is that it's really important to design a system, select trees, tree species, spacing, etc., independent of what funding is available, because you want to think about what you want first and then see what kind of funding is out there, as opposed to seeing what kind of funding is out there and then doing what the funding wants you to do. And Climate Smart Commodities won't be overly prescriptive, but it's really good to start from a point of your own context and then fit the right shaped peg into the right shaped hole.
I think that's sounds like excellent advice. And I want to dig a little bit more into that. And maybe it's around like this question I have on here about blind spots or pitfalls, because I can imagine that those can both be logistical in terms of implementation or financial, because it is a longer term investment. Sort of related to that, I'm curious if you can talk about risk a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just talk about like where do folks typically get stuck when they are thinking about putting in agroforestry as part of the suite of farming that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think we can talk about risk in terms of managing expectations. I don't mean to go back and just talk about understanding your costs and your management before you actually plant something. But I think, first, really understanding the system before you plant it, and maybe going to someone else's farm and experiencing those trees before you plant them on your own farm and asking them about their experience, or working on that farm if you can at different points of the year. Another thing to look at is what other things you have going on. So say if October is an extremely busy month for you and chestnuts are dropping, then you're going to have that labor bottleneck. So you're going to have to do a whole lot in terms of whatever you're already doing before, but then you have the chestnuts on top of that. So you want to make sure trees fit with everything else that you're doing on the farm. Now, I think in terms of risk, another thing to think about is, we'll say crop loss with trees. This year we had a late freeze in the Finger Lakes, Hudson Valley. So orchards, didn't have a good May. It was an amazing spring. And then we saw a 25 degree night and blossoms died. And, a bunch of my chestnuts just got defoliated by the freeze. They're re-leafing. But that reduced my growth rates. And another farm in the Finger Lakes, they're going to have reduced yields of the chestnuts. And I think managing those expectations in terms of, say, every 3 years, you're going to have a weather or a pest event, whether that's spongy moth or anything else that defoliates the trees, that's going to make it a not fun year. And I think that's the same with all types of farming. Understanding how much reserve you need to have in the bank to get through rough years. Tree crops are definitely not immune to that. And agroforestry is not immune to that. I think one benefit of trees and crops combined is you just have a higher diversity. So if your, say, grass is growing really slowly in one of those new paddocks that you've seeded because the organic matter is really low, maybe the grass underneath that older treed paddock, cool season grasses, shaded, less evaporation, it's a hot summer, it's 80 plus degrees, the cattle don't want to eat, suddenly they go into the shade, and then you actually have this beneficial effect in terms of cooling, where cattle might gain 60% more weight in a day. That's a stat from Kentucky, when they have access to tree shade. So you do have risk of the component that you've just planted, but there are also so many synergistic effects of trees and crops combined.
Thinking about the weather, I have a two-part question. Maybe you can dive into one or the other. Kind of coming back to the financing piece, I'm curious how much ecological service opportunity factors into financing of specifically the producers that Propagate is working with, or of agroforestry systems in general. And then in terms of the planning process, this may not be an easy question to answer. What is, how do you factor in climate change? Like, are you able to put in, like, we anticipate every third year there will be an intense weather event and we're going to build that into the plan?
Yeah. I'll answer the first question first. The answer is yes. So we add loss events. So whether that's tree loss or crop loss, it's every N years, every 3 years, every 4 years, you have a specific type of weather event. So it's, and then you can say, all right, with a late frost, I'm going to lose 80% of my peaches, or with a certain pest, my chestnut yield is going to go down 20%, et cetera. So yeah, we definitely work that in. So on the question of payment for ecosystem services, I really love diving into this. So it's important to think about ecosystem services as a very multifaceted concept. So I'm going to list a few of them, from probably most easy to monetize, or not most easy to monetize, but most farm specific to least farm specific. So first, if you go and read about ecosystem services, recreation is often listed as an ecosystem service. So if you think about agritourism, that's kind of payment for ecosystem services to a certain extent. And that is largely fully within a farmer's capacity to monetize. So that's on the left side of the spectrum, left side of the chart. Next, we can look at maybe something like water quality, where there generally is funding available in many locations for upstream restoration for improved water quality downstream. We've worked with a number of organizations, Stroudwater Research Center in Pennsylvania, to plant riparian buffers up the Chesapeake, Susquehanna watersheds. So that's a more geographically constrained ecosystem service. Looping in with that, we'll say flood control is similar. So for every, so 1 acre of parking lot has the same amount of runoff as 36 acres of forest. It's either 35 or 36. So when you increase that permeability upstream, then it's just it's a big sponge. It's a buffer for downstream flood events. And I think personally, that is a very underexploited ecosystem service to fund. So floods, biodiversity credits are definitely a thing. So adding hedgerows, buffer strips of native wildflowers, pollinator plants. The Xerces Society is a really good place to look for species there. I have my favorites. Payment for biodiversity, I think that's going to be, say, county by county, state by state, what a certain office is up for funding. So we're moving from the left side of the chart to the right side of the chart. We'll say least geographically constrained is probably payments for carbon. And there's a lot of buzz around this right now. And the number of different prices that you'll see is that it's diverse, to say the least. So you'll see anything from $8 to $500 a ton of CO2 equivalent to sequester carbon in either agricultural soils or woody biomass, trees, trunks, roots, branches, etc. And there are opportunities for carbon payments for folks that are looking to really lean in there and obtain carbon revenue. I think at this point in time, the story is really important. So usually buyers of carbon aren't just looking to offset their carbon, but for all, or but also for a, we'll call it a potential story for marketing value. So if you have carbon that looks really good and has a lot of co-benefits, then I think there's a lot more opportunity there.
Of the farmers that you're working with, what percentage are leveraging those types of funding streams as revenue for agroforestry?
I would say 20% are looking at or obtaining subsidies and payments for ecosystem services. How significant those payments are is really important to look at. So you can get a small subsidy, and you have to look at that in the grand scheme of things in terms of how much is that going to increase your return or offset your implementation costs. So a good percentage, and I think there's opportunity to do more.
That's great to hear. I mean, my sense is that there's a lot of excitement around ecosystem service. I think there's a lot of folks who are testing a lot of interesting and innovative models. But I think in terms of them being practical vehicles for farmers to access, I have yet to sort of see a tool that feels really easy to plug into. So I'm curious also if what of those, is there one that is like, this feels like the lowest hanging fruit and will be the thing that is more easy for farmers to access?
Of the non-farm specific payments, so not just having events at your farm. Okay. I would look up folks like Working Trees and other entities that are trying to make that pathway easier. So there are folks that are doing it. Regen Network and Nori are also really interesting. It gets easier for, we'll call them carbon or ecosystem service brokers, to do projects that are of a larger scale. So they might have the same transaction costs for 10 acres of agroforestry or for 1,000 acres of agroforestry. So it's in their best interest to look at larger producers. So I think if anyone is in the 100 plus acre range, then basically the opportunity cost of your time in going to acquire payments for ecosystem services is going to be lower because the upside is going to be much higher, because you'll just be able to get paid more for your carbon, or not paid more for your carbon, but paid more for carbon because you have more carbon to store.
This episode is also brought to you by the Regenerate Conference. Each year, the Kavira Coalition, Holistic Management International, and the American Grass-Fed Association collaborate to convene ranchers, farmers, conservationists, land managers, scientists, and thought leaders to share knowledge, build community, and create a culture of resilience and regeneration. Join us this year, November 1st through 3rd in Santa Fe, to explore regenerative agriculture at every scale, from microbial soil communities to social relationships and markets, to our changing climate and everything in between. Learn more and get registered today at regenerateconference.com. Are you passionate about sustainable agriculture and gardening? Then visit the Acres USA bookstore today. They have the best selection of books on sustainable agriculture and gardening from leading authors like Elliot Coleman, Mark Shepard, Andre Liu, and others. Get 20% off any Acres book purchase today with the discount code T20. Shop bookstore.acresusa.com and support sustainable agriculture. That's great. So maybe sort of bringing things back to a little less the financing and a little more the agroforestry part of this discussion. I'm curious, what size of operations is Propagate working with? How much range is there? And yeah, sort of like what feels like the best scale for you all in terms of thinking through? And I know that you've talked a lot about how holistic context is so important, and scale definitely is one of those factors. But what feels like the sweet spot, I guess? Yeah, what's the range that of sizes of farms Propagate's working with? And what feels like a real sweet spot in terms of opportunity for agroforestry?
Absolutely. The great thing about agroforestry is that it scales up and down really well. So we have farms in the tropics that are less than an acre of, we'll say, analysis scope, just looking at cacao agroforestry, very multi-species. And then we have very large grain and livestock farms. So 3,000 plus acres that we're working with. So the analysis part of what we do is really scale agnostic. It's probably best to look for other folks if you're just looking at your backyard, for sure. So I'll run through a few different ways that we work with producers, and then kind of circle back to the scale side of things. We run the analysis, and then once someone has that information, they can go out and procure the trees themselves, install everything. It's generally sets them up for success, reduces risk, increases certainty. And if they want to continue working with us, we can essentially procure the trees for them, because we do a lot of that. So it's pretty efficient for us to do that for people at very different scales of farming. We planted an 8-acre black locust plantation this past spring. That was smaller, the smaller side. And then folks can contract us to install an entire system. On that same vein, part of what I wrote about in the Acres article is that I think there's opportunity for more agroforestry contractors out there. So say taking April, part of May, depending on where you are in the US, to like a fencing contractor would plant trees. A lot of people have the equipment necessary, and the more people that are doing this, the better. So we have, just with Propagate, analysis, tree procurement, installation, and then financing. I would say, again, going from left to right, smallest acreage definitely on the left. Financing right now is on the larger acre side. So we can look at 1 acre of agro of, say, vegetables and black currants or blueberries or something like that. We usually let other folks run the economics for vegetables. There's a lot of there are a lot of other people out there that are great at telling you how to grow spinach, and we do less of that. We can go from small scale to large scale. Financing is usually on the larger side.
I guess maybe I'll reframe my question about the sweet spot a little bit, which is just like, and maybe you can speak to specific crops also, like, where is their market opportunity or growing market opportunity for agroforestry products, and at what scales? Because maybe that's the sweet spot question, because maybe blueberries is a different sweet spot than chestnuts or timber.
Yeah, 100% right there. Yeah. So 20 acres of black currants, you can mechanically harvest it, turn it into vinegar or cassis or jelly, and then have a phenomenal black currant operation. 5 acres is going to be hand harvest. So black currant, I mean, the biggest farm in the UK, I think, is like 700 acres of black currant, and that they sell to Ribena, but that's probably out of the norm for the United States or Canada. I think the biggest black currant farm in Canada is like 40 acres. It's outside of Quebec City. So there's your range on black currants. For chestnuts, you could plant right now, you could plant an acre of chestnuts and have that be worthwhile. You could also plant 300 acres of chestnuts and have that be worthwhile. Locust scales down if you want to contract the sawing of boards or selling posts, but I'd say you're probably looking at planting black locust if you want to have black locust enterprise selling posts or wood. Probably over 20 acres is a good idea if you want a value add. What else? I don't mean to give wild ranges here. Maybe I'll try and give a benchmark. Currants, you should do 20 acres. Chestnuts, 20 to 30 is a good amount. Currants, you could do 10 as well. Locust, 30 plus. I feel like these are for the smaller farms. If you have thousands of acres, I would look at, timber is a great option. That could be in windbreaks or not.
Maybe you could also just briefly touch on sort of the geographic scope of folks that you're working with. You mentioned working with some folks in the tropics. I know that some of the crops that you're talking about are much better adapted to an acidic soil type, which to me says East Coast and maybe a little bit in the Midwest. But are you working with folks all over? And if so, can you talk a little bit about how geography impacts some of this conversation?
Absolutely. So I'll go west to east. We have a few different analysis projects in Hawaii. One of those is a breadfruit alley cropping system that was deployed on the Big Island in Hilo last year. That's super exciting. Breadfruit, if you haven't had it, it looks like a cantaloupe, but on the inside, it's like a really good tasting potato or a plantain. It's like almost, probably almost twice as good as a potato, if you want that precise. 1.8 times as good as a potato. Breadfruit's amazing. That's a tangent. All right. So Hawaii, one project in Washington, that was an analytics project. They just used overyield. And then Texas, basically crossed the 98 degrees west longitude, going east where it starts to rain again. Project in Wisconsin, Tennessee, Kentucky, Georgia, and then up into New York. And that's really New York's probably the core of where we have the most analyses and deployments going on. We also working with Dimitri Sitos, who runs the Regenerative Agroforestry podcast, another fantastic podcast to check out. He ran through 10 different Mediterranean crops for us in Europe. So if you're in Barcelona or Montpellier, then overyield will work very well for you as well. He's bringing those crops to a California context. So if you want to do pistachios or almonds or olives, California propagate is fair game. And tropics. We did work in the Dominican Republic for actually syntropic cacao. So that's syntropic agroforestry it's a technique of establishing this biodiverse food producing high biomass system where you have multiple levels, ground crops like cassava, and then you have these biomass species that you're pruning and using them as mulch, cacao, plantains, breadfruit, avocados, bitter orange, timber for poles, timber for saw logs. That's going to make more economic sense, at least in its current iteration, the lower your labor rate is. So Cintro is really great for like Haiti or the DR. As you go towards a labor rate that's like over $4 or over $6 per hour, then it's going to make more sense to mechanize more.
I asked you before about where are there market opportunities. I'm curious if you can talk more broadly, just like, and specifically, like, what are the things that feel most exciting and sort of innovative happening in the agroforestry space right now? And then maybe more specifically, like, how is Propagate responding to those?
So there's what's economically interesting and then operationally interesting. I think those might be somewhat different. Elderberries are growing extremely quickly. I think it's the fastest growing supplement in the US by market size. So if you want to make elderberry syrup, that's probably a great thing to do. As Propagate, we go back and forth in terms of how much we want to get involved in purple berries, because like black currants and elderberries are phenomenal. And the maximum acreage of the US elderberry or blackcurrant market is smaller than that of chestnuts. And they're just smaller shrubs. So it can be still agroforestry, but like, we just like trees as a business, like big trees. So we're more excited by chestnuts than we are with elderberries. Not to say that we don't like elderberries. Like, elderberries are great. Grow elderberries if you want to grow elderberries. But we like chestnut pancakes more than we like cough syrup. So, all right, other market opportunities. On a small scale, especially if you have marginal ground that you can hopefully decrease herbaceous pressure on, I think basket willow is really interesting. And that, on a small scale, presents a value add opportunity. So you can grow willows, turn them into baskets. As you scale that up, that might look more like cattle eating willows. So you can think about this technique called intensive silvopasture, which is a lot more common in the tropics with species like Leucaena and Tetonia, which are woody shrubs that cattle eat in addition to the grass below them. In Australia, Leucaena is popular in Queensland. When the grass goes dormant, the woody plant has roots that go down further. So maybe if you're in the Gulf Coast of Texas or in Florida, it is listed as an invasive, but it's native to like Guatemala. So no one told the shrub as it moved northward. But yeah, fodder is really interesting. So fodder and basket willow on two different scales there in that spectrum. Chestnuts are always great. In terms of like heavy hitters for ecosystem services, hybrid poplar is always up there because it absorbs runoff really well, nitrogen and phosphorus. In France, lumber costs three times more than it does in the US. So it makes more sense to grow hybrid poplar for wood. So it's not going to be a huge moneymaker. There is one clone that has a figured grain that's really interesting. Black locust probably has one of the higher carbon accrual rates and sells for the same price as black walnut lumber for the most part per board foot, but takes a third of the time to get a saw log. So you have this fast growing hardwood, it's rot resistant. The one pest, there are two pests, but the main pest you have to watch out for is the locust borer. that, yeah, so Locust is great. It's easy to add value to if you're a woodworker, or if you just want to grow fence posts, that's good as well. So.
And in terms of Propagate, I mean, it sounds like these are all crops that you all are excited about working with and exploring, but are there any other developments there that are close or on the horizon? Sounds like your overyield software is relatively new, but that it's been a really positive development in terms of the work that you're doing. Is there anything along those lines that is new that you'd like to share with this audience?
I think, if you have a large amount of acidic, well-drained soil, definitely reach out to us regarding chestnuts. The next crops that we're going to bring online are short rotation timber species. So between those and hazelnuts, the bottleneck with hazelnuts right now, there are a whole lot of folks involved in that, whether it's Rutgers with the blight resistant European genetics or the host of people like Z's Nutty Ridge, Savannah Institute, Badger Set. I know I'm forgetting names there, so please don't let that be exhaustive with the hybrid hazelnuts. The constraint there is the amount of nursery stock. So when we crack the tissue culture code of getting hazels up to production, either via tissue culture or just cloned via hardwood cuttings, layering, etc., that is going to be a huge opportunity because Ferrero, Nutella wants to buy. Again, there's the global supply of hazelnuts is less than the demand. So people want to eat more hazelnuts than there are hazelnuts to eat. You really have to understand your harvest metrics there. Hand harvesting and processing a few hazelnut shrubs takes shrubs worth of hazelnuts takes a long time. So, do your due diligence in terms of hazels. But I think in the next 10 years, that's a huge opportunity. Yeah, chestnuts, hazels, locust, poplar. That's probably not in that order. But yeah, what Propagate is most keen on right now.
I'm going to wrap up with a couple of questions. The first is, what are you listening to or reading that you think folks who are interested in agroforestry should really be tuned into?
Yeah, I'm reading, actually, I have them right here. It's Coppice Agroforestry by Mark Krawczyk. That's been phenomenal. This one is How to Build a Natural Swimming Pool. This is just what I'm reading right now, because if I'm going to dig a pond, I want to be able to swim and do flip turns in it. Cause I don't think building a pond with walls to do flip turns in is that much more expensive than just building a pond. So, I'm trying to do that due diligence slowly on top of all of my other work. And then, our team is reading Demand Side Sales. So how to improve sales better, listening to on podcasts, the Regenerative Agroforestry podcast is always great. I listen to basically the Quebec version of NPR a lot. It's basically pop science and general news to inform myself and learn French at the same time. So that's good. I listen to The Economist a lot. Investing in Regenerative Agriculture is another really good podcast with Kuhn. Let's see. Yeah, there are more. We could go on for a while, but yeah, those are good places to start.
That's great. Thank you. And maybe the last thing that we can just touch on is, if a farmer is interested in working with Propagate, I know you mentioned this earlier on, but how should folks be in touch?
Absolutely. So we have an intake form on our website, propagateag.com. You can reach out to mark@propagateag.com. He's our first point of contact. He's super helpful, very knowledgeable on agroforestry. So you can email us there. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're not as prolific as we would like to be on social media. So if you're a Regen Ag social media marketing specialist, maybe you should reach out to us as well.
That's great. That's a great plug. Any other last closing thoughts that you'd like to share with this audience in terms of your current work or agroforestry more broadly?
I'm making a presentation for tomorrow on longleaf pine, but that's an aside. I would say that agroforestry is a lot of fun and it never gets old and there are always new things to learn, and engaging in an enterprise, a system, an endeavor that's going to last for longer than I will, longer than we will, is often it feels good. It's empowering, and it's worthwhile.
That's wonderful. I agree. I think that planting trees, there's kind of nothing better in some ways. Well, Harry, thank you so much for taking some time with me today. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you and learn a little bit more about Propagate specifically and agroforestry more broadly. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you. And until next time.
Thank you for listening to Tractor Time, a podcast production of Acres USA. Find us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and other popular podcast platforms. Find other Acres USA media and learn about Acres events at acresusa.com. We'd like to thank Acres USA staff for their contributions to producing this podcast. This episode was edited and engineered by Brad Parsons of Train Sound Studio. And we're grateful to our guests for taking the time to talk with us about their experiences. Today's episode was sponsored by C90 Ocean Minerals, the first step in regenerative agriculture. Remember, the fall is the best time to enhance soil fertility for next season. Learn how at c-90.com or give them a call at 717-580-1458.